Mr. Mylan?
Ayanda, I see in the chat that Honorable Lizipo has asked Honorable Mahlwale to stand in for him and proceed with the meeting because he's struggling with network purposes. Just from a procedural perspective, are we not supposed to elect a chairperson if the chairperson is unavailable?
That's correct, Mr. Mylan. We have to elect a chair, the acting chairperson. Let me just find out from the chair what is whether he cannot open the meeting or what is the problem. Then I'll revert back. But the procedure, we have to elect the acting chairperson.
Thank you, Ayanda.
Thank you.
The representatives of different formations that will be making presentations today. I don't want us to go deeper. Honorable members, the problem is that if I go to the small room, surely some board I can request someone to stand in. It becomes a different story to someone who's not present in the meeting. The question is when that person at that time is present in the meeting but is unable to participate in the meeting. I think that is why I was making the request. But I have tried to find a proper location for now, and I hope I'll be a bit audible in the meeting today. But at the appropriate time, there's just a small problem of a connection as far as network is concerned. but without any further ado, we had, can we get, if there are there any apologies?
Good morning and thank you, Chair. We have not received any apologies, Chair.
No apologies. Okay. Thank you very much. Today we are receiving, I don't want to spend time myself talking, good people. It's just to stick to the time allocated to all of us so that we can use the available time that Parliament has granted us to you to work on. We work on the basis of a 3-hour meeting, according to the rules, or the regulation for all committees of Parliament. So when we give time, we have to give time according to what is allocated to us. We are dealing with the written submissions that were received by the committee. But I'm trying to check whether, in terms of the minimum requirement, do we meet? Yes, I think we do. The minimum requirement of members for a meeting to proceed, if I'm not mistaken, it's 4, isn't it? Ayanda and Ari?
We do form a quorum, yes, Chair. There are 7 members in the meeting.
Okay. Then yeah. there's no qualm on that. We how many time we allocated for each presentation so that we can be accommodative of each other?
We provided 20 minutes to each stakeholder, Chair.
Okay. Please, good people, let's try and stick to that. The point I was requesting was that as and when I get disappeared, can Honorable Mahlwale stand in? I could imagine once you are still voting and then I come back, or when that person has been appointed or elected as an acting chair, before he could even say hello, I'm back in the platform. That was only the request I was making just as a stand-in. But who is the first to
the National Energy Regulator of South Africa, Chair?
Okay, it's NERSA. NERSA, please, can you be exemplary on your 20 minutes? You can still be below 20 minutes. You are allowed. It's now 10 past. It means at 5:30 you will be done.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning, members. Yes, Chairperson, we will make sure that we finish the presentation before the time that is allocated, as we had forwarded it before to the members. Chairperson, would like to thank you for inviting NERSA to share its views and also the experiences and challenges that we have encountered during the implementation of the Gas Act, and perhaps some proposals as we have based on the on those challenges and experiences. I have my team to assist. We forwarded the presentation. If they could just show the presentation so that I can go straight to it. Starting off with the outline of the presentation, if you can put it in the presentation form. It's quite small, just make it bigger for the members to see. Chairperson, my name is Nomfundo Maseti. I'm the full-time regulator member responsible for the regulation of gas at NERSA, and I'm representing NERSA today in terms of the views that I will present before the committee today. In terms of the outline, Chairperson, we will just start off with the introduction just to set the scene and also talk to the policy imperatives that are tied to the objectives of the Act, as well as the key amendments that could strengthen the regulatory mandate of NERSA in terms of ensuring that there's better regulation and efficient regulation, so that we can be able to respond positively to the needs of the industry, and also provide comments on the bill and the proposals of the new sections. And they will end off with the key messages. This needs to be expanded, but in terms of the introduction, the chair, as we know, NERSA administers at least a three sector specific legislation, one for electricity, and also there's a separate one for gas, as well as the petroleum pipelines. In terms of the key responsibilities, NERSA, now if I zoom into gas, implements the Gas Act of 2001, as well as the regulations. The rules are therefore made by NERSA, and we develop these rules as well as the methodologies in order to just amplify processes and how we will deal with certain regulatory aspects of the Gas Act. So those are all the regulatory framework that we work within. And also in terms of the objectives of the Act, we make sure that we facilitate
recording in progress.
We facilitate investment, promoting the orderly development of the sector, and promoting competition and the monitoring of the developments in the industry. Now, how do we give effect to these objectives? We issue licenses to license the gas infrastructure in terms of regasification infrastructure, LNG, pipelines, transmission or distribution. And we also license the trading activities downstream. In terms of the trading activities, we need to make sure that we also approve and monitor tariffs as well as the gas prices. So they're slightly different here compared to the other industries. So from the gas side, once we talk about tariff, we will talk about just the costs or charges pertaining to the utilization of the infrastructure. And when we talk about gas prices, we're talking about the charges pertaining to the molecule itself, and therefore the framework, the legal framework is such that we then have to add, on top of the molecule charges, add all of the tariffs, the distribution tariff, the transmission tariff, the storage tariff. So you add, and even the LNG regasification tariff will therefore be added on top of the molecule charges. And then in terms of the mandate itself, the gas exploration and production upstream is outside of the mandate of NERSA. It is regulated by PASA, and also LPG regulation in terms of the prices of LPG is by the department. And then also there is that fragmentation where there's LPG in the Gas Act, as well as LPG in the Petroleum Pipelines Act, Both apps are administered by NERSA, and the other, the third one, where LPG is also mentioned, is regulated by the department. I'll move on quickly to the next slide. The next slide deals with the proposed amendments to the Gas Act, and we do support the amendments that are proposed, as we believe that they will strengthen the regulatory mandate of NERSA, especially when it comes to gas prices and tariffs. Why we say so, it is because in the Gas Act, NERSA does not have powers to set the tariffs. And it frustrates the regulatory processes, because if you come to a different calculation and you have included, you have scrutinized all of the other costs, even when you have done so and you come to a lower tariff or price, you can't then set that price. You can't say, this is the price. It means you must take it back, because you cannot set that price. You can just approve what has been applied. So that is the key thing that we need to be emphasize in terms of the core regulatory powers that are weak in terms of the Gas Act. Third-party access, also, this is quite important if one needs to drive transformation and also drive inclusion. That is the aspect that one can look at in terms of regulating for inclusion and diversity and transformation. Those things are quite important to be achieved through third-party access, as we know that capital infrastructure, also capital for rolling out infrastructure, is quite massive. And also to stimulate gas infrastructure investment and to develop the gas market. And also we think that it is important in terms of promoting competition in the gas market, and so that, because we have a monopolist in this market, and therefore we need to make sure that at least there is this investment to promote competition. We can move on to the next slide. In terms of powers to regulate maximum gas prices and tariffs, I've already stated that NERSA only has powers to approve, not to set prices. That's the first thing. The second one is the prices that are approved must be at the maximum level. From there, licensees can charge any price below that maximum level. So that is the important thing. And the proposal here, which we support, is that the prices will therefore be set so that the regulator at least is given at least reasonable powers that will not frustrate its effectiveness, as well as the regulatory processes. And also, what is key there is that because we the Gas Act is based on the principles of competition, before NERSA could even approve prices in a market such as the one that we have, where there's no competition, where parties have market power, they can charge very high prices. It means NERSA cannot just control those prices or say anything until NERSA first makes a decision on whether competition or the state of competition is sufficient. So that is the prerequisite before NERSA could consider any application for maximum prices. I think that's the emphasis in terms of at what stage do we even discharge our mandate when it comes to prices. So that's the critical part that presents some challenges as well. And we're not saying that it just should not be competition review. It must be there, but perhaps the issue of conditional intervention by the regulator based on competition is something that perhaps may need to be looked at carefully. In terms of the tariffs, it's a weak regulatory powers again. We don't approve, we set the tariffs. And also there is no statutory powers in all of the tariff or other areas of natural monopoly. That area of natural monopoly is the distribution pipelines. It is a natural monopoly. However, there is no power to set tariffs or even to approve tariffs. And it is a serious, I think, regulatory gap. And we have seen it where you will get a distribution tariff. The monopolist exploited a distribution tariff of 20 rands, but the one that we regulate, you will pay around 5 rands or 6 rands. So it shows where the monopolist will therefore exploit that regulatory gap in terms of the distribution, as we don't have powers to regulate. So that's what is happening right now on the ground. The powers to regulate maximum price and tariff are provided in the rules, in the proposed bill, and they are trying to eliminate to exercise the sole discretion of approving or setting maximum price and tariff when processing applications from licensees. I can move on to the next slide. I think this, I'm not going to repeat this, it's the essence of it is about areas where NERSA has no powers to set tariffs. First, it is on the distribution pipelines and it's a natural monopoly. Secondly, it is in the LNG facilities, particularly on the regasification side. On the regasification side, there should be a tariff. However, the Gas Act has missed that. So that leaves the industry exposed to higher gas prices, especially for the users. And I've just given an example of that to say that where we don't even exercise our regulatory discretion, the tariff for distribution is close to 20 rands. I think it's 19 rands and some cents. So it's quite expensive and it's exploitative to the consumers. That is just the essence of this slide. I will move on to the next one quickly. The third-party access, the emphasis here without really getting into the nitty-gritties of all of those bullet points. The first one, in terms of the policy objectives, is that third-party access is the principle that is key because where you have network and infrastructure, you don't want to give everyone, you allow everyone to roll out pipelines. So it is important that if there's already an infrastructure, you must therefore allow others to interconnect first or others to utilize that infrastructure at a cost, obviously. However, currently, when it comes to the LNG facilities, as well as the distribution pipelines, the Act does not allow others to utilize that infrastructure at the cost. So we think that it's a gap that needs to be addressed. If we don't use the third-party access principle, therefore we are also unlikely to advance the objectives of regulating for inclusion as well as transformation, because others may not have the amounts that are required to invest, and therefore they can simply utilize the infrastructure that is there. But also, if one has a merchant model where the owner of the infrastructure may not want to utilize that infrastructure for its own activities, but they would want market participants to utilize that infrastructure. So if you now don't have the third-party provisions in the distribution and LNG, you are unlikely, therefore, to fulfill that role. So that is the essence of this slide. The powers to enforce compliance and also just to increase the scope of compliance. This relates to the imposition of the fine and the discretion to suspend a license for a specified period of time in order to make sure that licensees comply with a notice that the regulator would have issued. So there is a new insertion by the department or by the committee in terms of Section 34A, as well as consent orders. We support that proposal because we believe that it will strengthen even the regulator's enforcement efforts through those two insertions. And we think that these provisions, therefore, are necessary to make sure that compliance and voluntary compliance is being enforced by the regulator, and also to prevent repetitive contraventions. Because the situation currently is that NERSA, unlike other regulators, it is very difficult for NERSA to get to a stage where it could impose an administrative fine. You simply have those provisions there. But every time that a licensee does something wrong, they know that, first of all, NERSA will always have to start by issuing what we call a yellow card. Every time it has to be a yellow card. For you to get to the red card, it will be only when you have given them, say, 3 months or 6 months to say correct the wrong that you have done. And if they then correct it at the last minute, you can't even say pay back all of that, you know, the overcharge to the consumer, you know, that you have caused. And it becomes a problem. So it is important that one gets powers to lend to a red card where you can see that the conduct of the market participant is not good and is exploiting consumers. And if now we don't have those powers, we will never get to that stage where you will then punish and deter any bad behavior by the market participants. So we support that provision on those bases. And also powers to regulate other hydrocarbons, we also support that objective insertion. The limited exclusivity for gas distribution. This one, without getting into all of the bullet points, the emphasis here is that the distribution pipeline is a whole lot of things. I don't know how it was left out. First of all, NERSA cannot stipulate or regulate any tariff. The second thing is that the distributors are given exclusive areas. Nobody else must come to that area. And what happens, sometimes they don't even develop that area. They will foreclose others in future and keep that area for as long as you have granted the license, because they are granted exclusivity. But that exclusivity cannot just come on its own without obligations. There must be obligations about the price levels, because you will be the only one playing in that area. So it's important that consumers are protected or other customers are protected, future as well as existing customers, in terms of price levels and also in terms of the supply. So it's important that there is mandatory access to distribution. Coming to the other sections, the definition of trading, it is suggested that it focuses on the sale of gas, if one needs to qualify as a trader. The challenge that we picked up there, or the impact, is that the definition completely excludes the sale of gas by a transmission company to a distributor as a trading. So it is something that needs to be looked at carefully in terms of the language that is in the bill currently. And if that is not looked at carefully, it will create a regulation.
Mama said, 2 minutes. I'm trying to help you. 2 minutes left now.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Let's move on to the to the next one. I think the eligible customer part is the new definition on the distribution. Let's move on to the next section. The next section relates to section 4.1 of the bill. It's an enhancement. It relates to the complaints and investigation. We think that it must just assist in NERSA to be proactive in terms of inquiring on the activities of the licensees. We can, in terms of the market inquiries, a proactive investigation without necessarily investigating based on complaint, but on our own accord. And the next one has to do with the proposal to recommend to the minister regarding any matter contemplated on the Act. In terms of this, really, this with the procedure, and we have provided the proposed solution based on the impact as we foresee it. We think that the new section should be added after session 4.1, and we have provided the wording there at right at the bottom of the slide as to what can be included. The next issue has to do with the new section on the applicant for a license for information that facilitate the lodging of the license application. We identified the challenge here, and we think that it is a duplication, and that duplication may cause unnecessary confusion and ambiguity. We therefore propose how such, in terms of the language of the act, of the bill, how that can be addressed in terms of in order to remove the ambiguity. Section 21.1p has to do with the price and the features of the market. And we identified again the challenge there, as we indicated in green, and we think that the recommendation that we are making there on enhancement and improvement, we think that it will provide the certainty and clarification on the issues that pertain to the features of the market that may impede competition and the smooth regulation. Others, Chairperson, we will not deal with all of them. As we have provided the impact as well as the proposals, they deal with excessive prices, things that we have seen and the challenges that we have encountered. And we also dealt with the procedures relating to registration of production activities. All of them are just for enhancement, Chairperson. And we would like to end it here, Chairperson, without taking a lot of time of the committee. But we are here, Chairperson, to clarify all of the questions that may come from the members. And we have also forwarded this presentation in time. If members have questions, we will be happy to provide a clarification. Thank you so much, Chairperson, for that.
Okay. Thank you, Narsa. Can I go to Climate Justice Charter Movement? Take us up until 2 minutes past 10. Just look at your watch. Stopwatch.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, for inviting the Climate Justice Charter Movement to be to share our oral presentations. I'm just going to share my screen. I hope that is visible, Chairperson. Thank you very much for inviting the Climate Justice Charter Movement to come and share our oral presentations to this committee. My name is Charles Semane. I'll be speaking on behalf of the Climate Justice Charter Movement. So as the Climate Justice Charter Movement, we are a very diverse movement that brings together many civil forces. We are a movement that is made up of labor organizations. We are a movement that is made up of media organizations, that is made up of faith-based organizations, a movement that is made up of women's organizations, a movement that is made up of academics, and a movement that is made up of some of the leading climate scientists, some of which have been part of the IPCC reports over the years. We are a movement that has a guiding principle, which are outlined in the Climate Justice Charter. The Climate Justice Charter has been endorsed by 262 organizations and counting. Now, the Climate Justice Charter is the world's first Climate Justice Charter. We developed it out of years of campaigning with our partners in labor, with the rural movements, with water-stressed communities. So it is the results of years of activism and academic work as well as scientific inquiries. So on the 16th of October in 2020, we handed over the Climate Justice Charter for adoption to our parliament, because we were asking parliament, and we still are asking parliament, to adopt the Climate Justice Charter as per section 234 of the constitution. Now, we know that South Africa has a history of charters. The Freedom Charter continues to be a guiding document for many things that we do. And the Freedom Charter was a response to specific challenges in a specific time. So the Climate Justice Charter is a response to the greatest threat that is currently facing us, the existential threat of climate change. Hence, we handed over the charter to Parliament last year, asking Parliament to adopt it because Parliament has the power to adopt charters as per Section 234 of the Constitution. And on the 16th of October this year, a representative from Parliament came to our Assembly, where we again made the call for Parliament to adopt the Climate Justice Charter. And on the 9th of November, we were outside Parliament, again reiterating the call for Parliament to adopt the Climate Justice Charter to guide us as a guiding document and a vision to make sure that we create a climate justice state that can deal with the crisis of that can deal with the climate crisis that we are currently facing. So as the Climate Justice Charter, we believe that fossil fuels are not the future and that we need to urgently transition towards renewables. But above and beyond that, we believe, and we have an intersectional understanding of the climate crisis, how it is already impacting on women, the most vulnerable in our society. So we reject this amendment as much as we rejected the original bill itself. So we believe that the bill violates Section 24 of the Constitution, because Section 24 of the Constitution gives everyone in South Africa a right to an environment that is not harmful to their health. Now, we believe that the continued extraction of these greenhouse gases undermines Section 24 of our Constitution. We believe that the right to health will be undermined by the extraction of very harmful greenhouse gases, which we understand and which have been scientifically proven to be extremely harmful, which undermine human health, the health of the workers, and also undermine the health of the communities. For example, the United States Environmental Protection Agency found that exposure to chemicals like benzene, like formaldehyde, like hydrogen sulfide in the process of shale gas extraction can cause cirrhosis, which is an incurable lung disease. It can lead to liver failure, autoimmune disease, reproductive disorders, and other illnesses, as well as increasing the risk to cancer. So further extraction of these greenhouse gases undermines our right to an environment that is not harmful to human health. And we also understand that the extraction of coal bed methane will require extensive use of our groundwater resources. Now, we do not have the luxury of further harming our groundwater in South Africa, knowing that within this decade, South Africa's water demand is going to outstrip supply by 17%. We know this because the Water Resource Group did an investigation together with the World Bank assessing South Africa's water and found that within this decade, Our water demand will outstrip supply by 17%. And we also know that many communities, especially rural communities, are living in perpetual day zero. Day zero may have made headlines when it finally migrated to the cities. But the fact of the matter is that many communities around the country, especially in rural communities, they are living in perpetual day zero. So we have to protect our groundwater resources. So we believe that this bill undercuts ecologically sustainable development that is envisaged in Section 24 of the Constitution by providing the legal framework and justification for an ecologically unsustainable industry. And we believe that doing so will be an intergenerational crime, because we have a moral and existential duty to protect the earth for future generations. If you look now, young people born now are more exposed to climate shocks. They are exposed to severe droughts. They are exposed to floodings. They are exposed to severe heat waves. We have a youth, we have a generation that is already paying the price for a problem that it never caused. It is already paying the price for climate change. So we have a moral and I would say existential duty to protect the earth for future generations. Now, further explorations of gas do not protect the earth for the current generation, and they certainly do not protect the earth for future generations. And we are further worried by the fact that the exploration of oil and gas through seismic exploration will destroy our marine life and our marine biodiversity. There is a lot more to lose in further continuing with fossil fuels than there is to gain. So we reject the use of seismic exploration, which is going to destroy our marine life, which is going to destroy our fisheries, which is going to destroy our coastlines, basically, to no benefit to the majority of South Africans. Hence, we believe that this bill does not pass the morally permissible standard of risk imposition in intergenerational ethics. The risks here will far outweigh any benefits. We believe that there are cheaper and more sustainable alternatives. We believe that offshore wind, for example, can... This was a study that was done by the Department of Mechatronics at the University of Stellenbosch, which found that wind energy can supply 2,387 terawatt hours of electricity annually. They're talking about deep water, offshore wind energy. Now, that would be 8 times our current energy needs. So we have vast amounts of wind energy potential in South Africa. Vast amounts. If we can explore our offshore wind energy, we can be able to meet our energy needs. And we also believe that, as has been proven by economic studies, that the cost of renewable energy systems and the unit cost of renewable energy generation, they have come down dramatically in comparison to fossil fuels. For example, when you look at solar photovoltaics, they show that they have the cheapest decline. From 2010 to 2019, you see an almost 82% decline, followed by concentrating solar power, which has seen a 47% decline between 2010 and 2019, followed by onshore wind energy, which has seen a 40% cost decline between 2010 and 2019. And you also see that electricity cost from utility scale PVs has fallen by 13% year on year. And what this shows is that the cost of renewable energies has been going down while the cost of fossil fuels has been going up. And the International Energy Agency has made it clear that there should be no new investments in oil and gas if the world is to achieve net zero by 2050. Now, net zero itself is a problematic concept because it is based on false solutions of carbon capture and storage. But if let's say, for example, we put net zero as a target for 2050, by continuing to further explore these fossil fuels and by locking in gas, we are not even going to reach shallow solutions of net zero by 2050, undermining our nationally determined commitments and undermining our commitments to cut our carbon emissions. So investments in renewable energy have more than doubled in comparison to investments in fossil fuels. The rest of the world is moving away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. And we have the renewable energy potential to not only be a leader in Africa, but a leader in an example the world over. So,
Sorry, sir, I made the mistake. Let me correct it now. I know you would not have corrected it because it favors you. It's not 10:02. It's supposed to be 9:52, which means you still have got 10 minutes to go.
Perfect, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Right. So Southern Africa is already warming at about twice the global rate of temperature increase. So if the world is to reach 1.5 degrees, as the IPCC report has shown, then Southern Africa is looking at a 3-degree overshoot. Now, a 3-degree overshoot for Southern Africa will be catastrophic, especially for us, a country that largely depends on rain-fed agriculture, because a 3-degree overshoot will mean extreme levels of evapotranspiration, making it very difficult for our farmers to survive under those temperatures, undermining our livestock, undermining our agriculture industry as a whole. As we have seen with the droughts from 2015, 2014 onwards, the El Nino-induced droughts, we are a country that is very vulnerable to evapotranspiration. We are very vulnerable to El Nino-induced droughts. So as the world reaches 1.5 degrees, we are likely to see temperatures up to 3-degree overshoot, because Southern Africa is warming at about twice the global rate of temperature increase, as climate scientists have seen. Now, this will lead to climate famines. This will lead to climate refugees. This will lead, inevitably, many people are going to die. Now, climate shocks are increasing in frequency and in severity. As we have seen all over the world, that climate shocks are increasing. We are now seeing climate famines all over the world. We are seeing them in countries like Madagascar. We are seeing climate famines starting to hit particular regions of the Sahel. So climate shocks are increasing in their severity and in their frequency. And we saw in 2021 that carbon dioxide levels reached 415 parts per million in 2021, as observed by the Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. Now, this was a record for the first time since records began. And another climatic tipping point is the fact that the Amazon rainforest is now emitting more carbon than it is absorbing. And due to large amounts of deforestation, this is catastrophic for the earth as a whole, but even more so for Southern African region, which is already warming at about twice the rate of temperature increase. Ice sheets are receding in the Arctic. El Nino droughts are becoming more frequent, as we have seen with the El Nino drought that, according to climate scientists, induced the droughts that we saw in Cape Town that led to day zero. But also with the understanding that there are communities in South Africa who are already living in perpetual day zero. So as the Climate Justice Charter says, that the charter is a call to all who care about human and non-human life to act together in advancing a plurivision of people's dreams, alternatives and desires for a deep and a just transition. And we believe that further pursuing legislation that creates a legal framework for further exploration of fossil fuels, which are destructive, which are leading to the greenhouse effect, will not help us in reaching a deep and a just transition. Hence, the Climate Justice Charter movement calls on Parliament to adopt the Climate Justice Charter and move away from the destructive path of fossil fuels, because fossil fuels are not the future. With that time remaining, I'll yield, and thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Wow, thank you very much, sir, and from your teams. You set a very good record. I'm sure all of us will meet. Is it Sakeliga or Sakeliga? Oh, sorry if I called the name wrongly. But it's Sakeliga. You can check the platform. You have done a favor. It means you will take us up to, that will take us up to 208.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, it is Sakeliga. So no worries on the pronunciation there. Honorable members and observers, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Martin van Staden. I'm a legal fellow at Sakeliga, which is a business community with over 12,000 individual and corporate members. Saul Kaliga is dedicated to the principle of more business, less politics in South Africa's commercial environment. And our litigation, our policy advocacy, and our campaigns around entrepreneurial independence really do speak to this principle. Now, my remarks today are as short as Saul Kaliga's written submission on the gas amendment bill was. We do not have much to contribute on the gas industry's specific aspects of the bill or environmental concerns. Our contributions relate only to those aspects of the bill that form part of broader trends that we see in other pieces of legislation as well. Now, in this respect, our contributions are a bit more limited than that of the other speakers. Now, Saul Kaliga is concerned about the renewed dedication evident in the bill to policy that is of a racial nature. The Gas Act has been on the statute book since 2001, and already there we saw provisions of this kind. But in our view, this cannot justify the same approach two decades later in a society that is constitutionally committed to non-racialism. Clauses 14 and 20 of the bill, in particular, reconfirm the obligation on firms in this sector to provide government with information related to the promotion of Black economic empowerment, and this seems to form part of the licensing conditions in the sector. Furthermore, Clause 31 of the bill allows the minister to make regulations to promote racial empowerment. Saul Kaliga has a very clear mandate from its members to publicly and vociferously oppose the continued legislative racialization of commerce in South Africa. While these policies are necessarily built on the good intentions of empowerment and righting the wrongs of the past, in practice they disincentivize wealth creation, they create unnecessary resentment, and they cause firms to try and stay under government's radar, meaning that there is inevitably less investment and in some cases even disinvestment. Clause 20 in particular is a cause for great concern in our view. It effectively allows a firm in this sector to have their license suspended for not complying with government's empowerment targets. Now, in this respect, one must remember that any economic activity is necessarily part of an ecosystem and never takes place in isolation. The mere fact that there is activity in this sector means that thousands are employed, that the economy is stimulated, that important goods are being created, and that the production process is being supported for consumption, and that South Africa is internationally competitive. In other words, the prosperity of the gas sector, just like any other sector, is in itself necessarily empowering. It is well and good for government to have an additional empowerment agenda, but by allowing the regulator to suspend licenses because this additional empowerment agenda is not being complied with, is in our view to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Research by the World Inequality Database appears to show that government's redistribution policies have benefited only a small number of persons designated as historically disadvantaged, while the vast majority of Black South Africans have only gotten poorer, and this is in the period of 1993, I believe, to 2017. And this, we argue, is a necessary consequence of having politics rather than economic and commercial considerations picking winners and losers in the economy. South Africa now more than ever, in our view, requires simple, pure economic activity. We have over 11 million unemployed people who can and should be working. We cannot afford to disincentivize economic activity any more than we currently are already. We should make it very appealing in all economic sectors, including this one, for firms to start up and start doing their thing, and for foreign investors to choose South Africa as their preferred destination of choice. We can certainly encourage and perhaps even incentivize compliance with empowerment targets, but that must be kept voluntary. And this bill, seen in the context of other bills, is moving away from that. coercive measures such as the suspension or the withdrawal of operating licenses or the imposition of fines must be completely out of the question, at least for as long as South Africans continue to suffer extremely severe economic hardships, especially now in the period of the post-COVID lockdown. Sokoliga therefore strongly recommends that the amendment bill be revised to be race neutral and to make the Gas Act itself race neutral. And we further and instead be revised to encourage more general economic activity in this sector in any way that it can. Moreover, Clause 31's unfettered discretion for the minister to make regulations regarding the promotion of racial empowerment is also concerning. And this is because when it comes to a sensitive area like racial policy, and I think we can all agree that this is a sensitive area, it is very imperative that such decisions of whatever scope and extent, or no matter how small such decisions are in their application, must be left to the people's elected representatives in parliament, you honorable members, in other words, rather than being left to officials and politicians in the executive branch who are exercising a discretion that has been granted to them. It is for that reason that we also recommend that any regulation-making powers that the minister might have in terms of the amended act exclude anything having to do with racial considerations. Now, honorable members, I'm entirely aware of the common objections to what I have said. There is always going to be a concern about what exactly South Africa should do to redress the legacies of past racial legislative discrimination. And this is certainly a very valid question. But in our view, it is unfortunate that this question always proceeds from the assumption that the government must use the law to do so. But this is not how any people have empowered themselves in history, at least not in a sustainable sense. There are plenty of examples of the government supporting the empowerment of a people, but the government cannot build a new economy from the ground up, nor should it try to. The reason that apartheid impoverished so many was precisely because it involved the government interfering in the economy and thereby setting aside the choices of the majority and thereby undermining their human dignity. Our courts have repeatedly emphasized the close connection between the value of human dignity and the ability to choose. While the National Party said that apartheid would empower everyone to be prosperous in their own regions, the very nature of political control of economic activity meant that any such goals were merely academic. In reality, attempting to regiment the economy according to political considerations always ends up being ruinous, usually most devastatingly for those that are meant to benefit by those policies. What government can and should be doing, in our view, is creating an environment that is friendly towards entrepreneurship and free economic activity. The first thing it must do is to remove any government-imposed obstacles to economic activity. And here one can think of Eskom's monopoly on power that acts as a massive barrier to economic growth and development, as we are experiencing now every few weeks with load shedding. One also thinks of the multitudes of compliance burdens imposed by laws such as the amendment bill. The second thing government can do is to make South Africa factually safe from crime and safe from political corruption. Doing only those two things in themselves will already provide the necessary environment for more and more people to do business, and the knock-on effects of that will be more employment for millions, more economic growth, more money in the economy for the poorest of the poor to start becoming productive participants in our economic system. In summary, honorable members, it is Sokoliga's recommendation that the gas amendment bill be revised to be race neutral and to limit ministerial discretion to technical affairs, to only technical affairs that do not directly or indirectly relate to any racial considerations. And with those short remarks, honorable members, I thank you for your time and I thank you for this opportunity.
done.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, okay. Very much. Like I said, I always have got this problem. The one who's following, I think it's the Green Connection. You can take us, it's 10 o'clock, take us to 20 past 10. Is Green Connection on?
It doesn't look like a chair. I've even asked in the chat, but it doesn't look as if they're on the platform chair.
Yes, there is Green Connection on the platform.
Oh. Okay. Take us through until 20 past.
Is my screen visible?
I've given you co-hosting rights now. So you can try now again, sir.
Are we visible?
Yes.
Good morning to you, Chairperson, and good morning to the Portfolio Committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Neville Van Rooy from the Green Connection, and we are so delighted for this opportunity to be able to share our stance on the Gas Amendment Bill today. So the Green Connection essentially is a community NPO working around the ocean areas, three provinces, the Northern Cape, Western Cape, and Eastern Cape area. And we have essentially have a campaign hashtag Who Stole Our Oceans. We are an organization that is built on the framework and the foundation of Section 24 that relates to an environment that is not harmful to our health and well-being. And we are doing work all around the coastal communities, especially a focus on small-scale fishers and how looking specifically at their livelihoods as well. And we have been starting this campaign since 2020, and we've been rolling it out to these various communities in these three provinces. Yeah, relating to the Gas Amendment Bill, it is important for us to look at, we cannot look at this amendment bill in isolation with international research, especially relating to the IPCC's research that has already been done and been tabled for us as a global community. It's important for us to look at any fossil fuels, energy type related issues in relation to what has been said in borrowing from international research that is already in place. It's important for us to look at that. So we know it's important for us to look at how we approach nature and our economy and also livelihoods related to how people live and how people survive in the areas close to the coastal communities. It is important for us to measure our livelihoods in a sustainable manner in terms of where we are going, what type of future do we want as a community, and how do we relate that to an international way moving forward? What type of future do we envision for ourselves, and specifically also looking at livelihoods of the different communities that we are working with? It's important to look at how the environmental and social justice relate to those communities especially. And for us, it's important when we hear about gas, we know that it's important for us to know that gas is not, you know, part of the future that we see ourselves in. We envision a future without gas based on the climate emergency that we're finding ourselves in currently. It is important to take note of the rest of the world migrating away from fossil fuels currently. And we are alarmed of the fact that as a South African continent or Africa, we don't want to be last on the bandwagon of exiting this fossil intensive industrial activity in our country, in our continent. And when we essentially say just transition, we do not necessarily mean the same as the government framework and understanding of a just transition. We need a transition that is already beginning to make the exit plan, as in immediately now, so that we can move away from fossil fuels, oil and gas, that is so harmful to our environment, that is threatening not only the environment, the ocean, acidification and sea level rise and all those type of complications, but also limiting and restricting and harming livelihoods of communities that is dependent on that very environment next to the coastal regions of South Africa. Currently, I'm working on the coastal towns, and my experience with these communities is that they are most of the time left out of public participation processes that is so key to developments happening around the coastal areas. To my shock, communities is always the last to hear about gas infrastructure or offshore oil and gas activities in the ocean. And that is one of the areas that is so alarmed for us. And public participation is a key process for communities to be involved in, to say if they want the oil and gas activities in the ocean or in their surroundings. And many times in my experience, these communities have to blow the whistle almost halfway in the discussion to say that we are here. Can you notice us as well? Do we have a say? Do we have a right? So this is my experience working around the areas that I've been working around. And this is one of the issues that is so important for us also to be recognized into communities have a say, communities have a right, communities have a voice. And sometimes this voice is being sidelined by industry and government partnerships. And it's not, processes is not working very well as far as that is concerned. And that is one of the reasons we are opposing this gas infrastructure because processes is not running smoothly. It's not running according to what we know it should go according to. We also know that the National Environmental Management Act clearly states that there need to be public participation, and in many cases we find it's not the case. And that is something that we really do want to bring to the committee as well under your attention, that this needs to be done correctly. The other issue for us is also in terms of the climate discussion, it's important for us to see that in this gas amendment bill, why is there not a clear exit or transition plans in place as a matter of urgency and priority in terms of moving away from fossil fuels. It's rather, it is being stayed or rather continue down this pathway of fossil fuels. I fail to understand why we are staying on this road of fossil fuels. It's while we have to make means to exit this dirty energies in our ocean, on our land. And essentially, the Who Stole Our Oceans campaign has to do with people's livelihoods and being connected to that environment. And economy is not divorced from an environment. It runs side by side with that environment and that economy. So it needs to be operated in a sustainable manner that the planet and the economy work hand in hand, not something that is dirty, is pollutive, intensive in the area. And oil and gas is really harmful to our environment. And it's just important for us that the transition needs to be a one that is implemented now. It cannot be delayed. It cannot be just more promises of...
You are losing you, sir.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Am I back? Can you hear me? Jefferson, can you hear me now? Am I audible now?
I under. Pause.
Am I audible? Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yes, so... Yeah, so it's important for us to know that climate change is no longer just a distant phenomenon. It's something that is here. Someone has already mentioned the zero water crisis of Cape Town. There's the water crisis in the Karoo. We are a few days away from extreme weather patterns. Examples that we have seen in the coastal town of George. So that needs to be taken into account in terms of pumping more fossil fuels, pumping and working and destroying the land for more fossil fuels in the area where we people, where people's livelihoods is actually being built. Yeah, we know what type of future we want as a people. People know what type of future they want, and that needs to be respected. And now that means a future that is without fossil fuels. So we would request from the portfolio committee to really start this discussion of moving into a renewable energy type of a energy framework or energy future that we really know is sustainable for our country, where we know that our country speaks for itself in terms of renewable energy potential that we have in this country is enormous in terms of solar and wind and biofuels or biogas that we are able to tap into, and that possibilities need to be explored. Why is it being not ignored? Why is it being ignored? So that possibilities need to be explored much more vigorously, because we don't, as a country, we don't want to get on the bandwagon of exiting the fossil fuel industry last, and or being on the climate crisis wagon last again. But we want to be part and parcel of that change and that transition in the right time. We have maximum 10 years to, you know, for this existential crisis to hit us, and it will hit us as the African continent the hardest. We need to be bear that in mind, that we need to exit as a matter of urgency. The climate emergency is something that really needs to be taken serious. And when we see more gas, when I do my visits around the country and I see that there's another seismic scoping, that I see there's another oil and gas environmental impact assessment out, it just shows that our country is not serious about the transition that they're talking about. Is we're not sure the President Climate Commission, what type of discussions is being held there. Why is it not discussions that is exiting us from using more fossil fuels? So thank you, Chairperson. Thank you to the Portfolio Committee for this opportunity to just share our ideas around this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was on record time, obviously. The fact that, let me say, I appreciate the cooperation that you are giving to this committee. Like I said, I'm not going to be the one who's the star, speaking more than any other one. Honorable members, I'll do you a favor. From NERSA, to ask this, listen very carefully. No comment. Just questions of clarity on the issues they've raised without being positional. Because they can't say something that you want to hear. We may disagree with what they are saying, but something that will help us or will help you as a member of the committee, that when you make your point, when we do deliberations, you know that you are making a point exactly on what the person would have said in the meeting. Something that you want clarity, that you may not understand what is the meaning. Obviously, they can't say things that we all agree or that we agree with. They're entitled to do so. So the clarity should be about avoiding distortion. Just in the event we make reference to the point that they would have made. Please, bear with me, just in 2 minutes, and no comments, just questions of clarity. From NERSA up to the last presentation. Is there any Okay. I don't see any hand of clap. Nesta, accept it's a pair with my insensitivity. It is because you are, we like asking a very irresponsible question. Because some people here, even from the president, might be asking that question. But have you made contributions? Because one would have assumed that the NERSA is part of those that are proposing the amendment. I didn't want to question or to block any written submissions. But can I ask that question? Have you been part to the department of the proposals, the amendments? And if so, what has been that would have been?
Chairperson?
Sure. With the network. No, my question is at my percentage. But one might say NERSA is an entity of the department. And if so, have you made presentations or were you part or not part of the development with regards to the proposed amendment? And if so, what has been the attitude of the department? I'm just raising it so that I couldn't question what is written, because any person who has written submitted the written submissions, we are supposed to go to accommodate that person. So that was the reason. But I've had that question myself, so I'm saying, let's ask it to be in the public. It might have benefited from the presenters. They might have that question that, but NERSA is a regulator. It's supposed to have been part of the development of this proposed amendment by the department. So have you been party to the development as an entity of the department on the proposed amendment?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, your line has been very bad. I'm hoping that I have captured the essence of your question. Yes, Chairperson, we have been invited during the development as a stakeholder to provide input when the department developed the bill itself. We are not part of the development of the bill. It is the responsibility of the department. NERSA was invited to provide input. And the bill, obviously, has been in the pipeline for a number of years, Chairperson. At the time when we had given input at the beginning of the process, it was in 2011. And we had asked for another opportunity, given the challenges over the years from 2011 onwards, and recently, Chairperson, as recent I think as September or October last year, we believe that the bill was again revised by the department. And we had, there was a meeting by the department of all stakeholders, but not particularly on the bill, but on gas issues in general. And we then raised issues to say that we would like to get an opportunity to comment on the new insertions that were in the bill. Unfortunately, then, yes, the department agreed, and unfortunately, then the bill was then submitted to cabinet before we could get that opportunity, because there were things that we could see they were not aligned, and they had said that we can submit to them as well. And unfortunately, the bill went to cabinet without us getting that opportunity on the newly revised version of the bill, which then had some serious issues that we needed to get an opportunity in order to be aligned with the department, and also just to indicate to the department what could be the challenges with the new insertions in terms of implementation, and also in terms of facilitation of investment, and also in terms of the customers. So some of those that we have also included here are those things that could not be included in the bill, given the fact that the department revised it again last year, during mid-year last year. So yes, Chairperson, we were invited during the development, but it took time. I think it's more than 8 years that this bill has been in the pipeline, and things have come up, and the new developments, and also the bill as well, was changed from that time up to the time it was then submitted to cabinet, and we missed the opportunity of commenting and providing input on the final version that was then submitted to cabinet and finally to parliament. And NERSA took the opportunity to say that we should not also miss the boat as an independent regulator. It is important perhaps to be part of the process in parliament, and where we can also assist as a stakeholder in parliament and as the entity that administers the act, it might be important that we participate in that process so that we can be able to clarify some of the amendments and our views should parliament need that assistance. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I said initially I do have a problem with the network, but I hope I'm back until I succeed. We have to ask those questions even if they are difficult, so that those who may not or who might be puzzled can be clarified. Can we go to South Durban Community Environmental Alliance? They will take us up to The South Durban Community Environment in
Environment Alliance.
Okay, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you so much. I'm just trying to share my screen. Okay. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay. So I am presenting on a submission from the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, and I work with Desmond Dessau in the South Durban Basin in Durban, of course. The South Durban Community Environmental Alliance. We are representing 21 communities and environmental organizations, and we focus on environmental justice and social justice in the South Durban area and in KZN. We also represent the vulnerable and disadvantaged persons whose lives and livelihoods, jobs, and small businesses all depend on the protection of ecosystems of KwaZulu-Natal and in the vicinity of Durban. CFC, as we most commonly know, has been around for over two decades now, and we are all for the improvement of environmental management in KZN and in the industrial areas of South Durban. With the gas amendment bill, we feel that it falls short when it comes to achieving many of the goals that it sets out in its introduction. I'm not going to read all the text on the screen because I am sure each of you have been through the bill. But it sets out a lot of objectives from broad-based economic, black economic empowerment, environmental sustainable development, socioeconomic development, and improving the private and public sector. And so we feel that while it is true that these are good objectives, the majority of this bill tends to focus on the government's relationship with the private sector, and it attempts to facilitate access to gas licenses. In terms of public participation, we feel that public participation, of course, is vital to all governmental processes and all processes that involve the environment. And all citizens need to be included, especially in terms of the gas amendment bill. The gas pipelines will be affecting a large amount of our communities. And so we have to get the most public participation that we can possibly get and get communities' input, because all communities should have a say on what goes on their land. In terms of the bill, in Section 6, it refers, we say that it needs to be reconsidered because the process needs to be more inclusive. So when applying to the energy regulator, it is important that there are public hearings where the public can express their concerns. And I know that this process is currently ongoing in terms of the public hearings. But just if we look at KZN as an area, there are a number of towns and communities in KZN. And there's 500 informal settlements, I mean, from northern KZN to southern KZN. There were a lot of areas that weren't even aware of the public meetings. So we feel that public participation was largely lacking. And in terms of venue location, the meeting in Durban was in Westville, and Westville is not even a central area. It's on the outskirts. Transport was an issue. Advertising, there was no documentation given well in advance so that the community could engage with it before the hearing. So we felt that that was missing. Concerns with the amendment itself, if you look at under Section 18.2, the insertion of this subsection is a concern to us. This, we feel, is in contravention of other national interests, for example, the protection of the ocean for future generations. And one of our questions that we raised was, does this idea of additional criteria mean that nurses' powers could be constrained? Should there not be a mandatory consultation period if the minister is going to specify such criteria? We feel that topographic aspects have not been considered in the bill, as well as that it's been promoted from Parliament, but not through the department and the ministry. And we feel that consultation should have started from that point. And the bill largely gives too much power to the minister, although we are aware that the minister does have a level of power. We feel that the minister's own department and the ministry failed to consult, of course, in advance. If we look at Section 21C, D, but again, goes back to public participation. Is it included? What principles does this pertain to? Will there be any public consultation around these principles in, specifically? if we look at 21C, section O, it mentions without undue discrimination. So our question around there would be, what does without undue discrimination mean? What is required from the developer? And we've also noted that it should be a clause that states that there needs to be free and prior consent from landowners, needs to be included since private land will be crossed. If we look at section 22A, it talks about exclusivity, which we do not agree with, because we know that exclusivity leads to monopolies and fixed prices, and this is not in the best in the best interest of the public at large. In section 23, if we're looking at the research shows and it proves that climate impacts of gas are far greater than those of coal per unit of energy. And so as a country, and in light of the Paris Accord and in light of just what came out of COP26 and where the global community is moving as a whole, we feel that it is a bit limiting to lock ourselves into gas dependency. And in terms of this section, there needs to be a reduction in the number of years, because this locks it into a 25-year period. As it stands, this approach does not lead to a just transition, which is what we're looking towards. So, as I mentioned, the Paris Accord, as a country, we need to be moving towards that. And so there's a need to look into the best available technology and move away from fossil fuels to achieve the targets set out in the Paris Accord. So in order to be in line with the Paris Agreement goals, South Africa would need to adopt more ambitious climate action beyond the Integrated Resource Plan, and look into increasing renewable energy capacity, phasing out coal-fired power generation, and avoiding investing in natural gas. And research has shown time and time again, I'm not going to read through all the slides, but research has shown time and time again the effects of gas are more intense than that of coal, and the research is also revealing higher downstream gas emissions than earlier predicted. So because we have new methodologies and technologies, we are able now to document the effects much better than we did previously. We know that the average life cycle emissions of gas are growing globally, because shale gas is growing as a percentage of all gas, but its production likely emits more methane and other greenhouse gases than any other conventional gas production. Even though the markets are growing, the large amount of gas to be burned greatly increases the gas's greenhouse gas emission, which does not enhance our environment or benefit our communities. Section 26 talks about compliance, which is very important. And being in South Durban, we are well aware of public health issues because there's a number of industries already in the area. We are calling for a strategic environmental assessment to be done that needs to be conducted where all parties are involved. A strategic environmental assessment must be developed before any amendments of the bill take place. The need for it needs to be assessed. Section 28A talks about the gas master plan being revised annually in line with the IEP. We feel that the gas master plan revision should undergo a strategic environmental assessment with each revision, which of course then goes hand in hand with inclusive public participation as part of this process. Again, we feel that the power given to the minister in this bill is quite a fair amount, and we don't want any infrastructure to operate without a determination. any deviations from the plan need to go through the proper consultation process. All communities need to be involved. The minister, as a political leg, cannot have absolute power. And while we recognize that he does have power, he needs to be guided by legislation. And the legislation needs to ensure that all people of South Africa are equal and no one is more equal. Because we do not want the bill to undermine the democratic law of this country. If we look at Section 32, expropriation of land by a gas energy regulator, the expropriation must ensure that protective measures for all natural parks and protected coastal areas cannot be expropriated. Especially, there are a lot of areas where there are communities that are close by, and these can be directly affected by gas pipelines. So there needs to be, this needs to be reconsidered. From a safety perspective, pipelines are a risk to communities. There are a number of incidents locally and globally where pipelines have blown up or have leaked, and there are a number of examples in our community in the South Durban area and in KZN. If we look at Section 33A, all companies who have intentions to dig up a pipeline, we feel need to first go under meaningful public participation processes with those stakeholders in the area 14 days prior to ascertain the dangers that lie underground. And if they are dug up, there needs to be remediation involved. There's no indication in the bill of safety or emergency measures as it stands. We feel that the bill focuses a lot on how to obtain licenses, but given much of the research that has come out since the original Gas Act was passed in 2001, the original bill must go to greater lengths to curb these emissions. We feel that the bill gives the energy regulator a great deal of discretion when it comes to the interpretation of it, and it's critical that more protections get codified into law if the government is trying to maintain clean air for future generations. So we need to try and look into cleaner sources of energy and some important sources of concern, such as sustainable development, are brushed aside and not gone into detail in this bill. Given the history of gas explosions, no license should be issued without public participation. A minimum of 60 days to consult needs to be adhered to. All stakeholders need to be consulted because there have been, as I said, an increase in gas leaks and incidences over the last few years. Again, I'm not going to go into detail, but we feel that the bill does not go into detail when it comes to looking at environmental sustainability, and while concrete measures is the government, what concrete measures is the government going to take to ensure that the development actually, in fact, takes into account environmental sustainability? What's the long-term plan? Does the government expect to use natural gas forever, or will it transition to other types of fuel? Those are just some of the questions that we had. And again, highlighting the fact that we need to look at alternatives. So while this is an option that's on the table, there are better options in terms of renewable energy sources that will benefit us and allow us to reach our goals in the long term. Production and usage of natural gas are likely to cause irreparable damage to the natural environment, as well as affect citizens of this country. So we believe that there are a lot of dangers involved, and the destruction from this is immense. And we advocate to move to a just transition, and it needs to be socially owned. In conclusion, overall, the bill proposal has not gone through a meaningful public participation process. But yet the same bill can result in a development that can affect millions of people across private land, schools, ecosystems across the country. So we feel there's still a lot of changes that should be made to the bill if the government is serious about accomplishing the goals laid out in the document. While the amendment makes it easier to promote the development of the gas industry and infrastructure, some of the other goals, including sustainable development, are almost completely disregarded in this act. The bill should be sent back to the department to engage meaningfully with people, as this bill fails the democratic test to include the citizens of this country whose views not only need to be ascertained, but also included in the policy and legislation. And that is just one of the references that we used. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. You were on point, on time. Center for Environmental Rights, take us through up until 11:06.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to you and honourable members for the opportunity to address you on the bill. Since our submitting comments, written comments on the bill on the 30th of July, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, has released the first of its reports in the sixth assessment cycle. And basically the news from there is that the climate crisis is more severe than has been found up to now, which is also leading us to enter a new era where pressure to respond is going to increase to new levels. We've also just had the COP26 climate negotiations in Glasgow, and a number of agreements were reached there which intend to accelerate climate action by all nations, including new emissions reductions targets to be submitted next year. So based on these developments, we want to take this opportunity to focus on the climate change aspects of the bill and amplify what is in our written comments, but the other aspects in our comments still stand. And in this regard, we'd like to support SEDSI's contentions around public participation, which we also mentioned in our submissions. If we look at the overall intentions of the bill, these three aspects: the promotion of orderly development of gas industry, to facilitate gas infrastructure development and investment, and to provide for socioeconomic and environmentally sustainable development, we submit that the bill in its current form is deficient and unacceptable for the reasons that we're going to go into. It's clear from the wording in the preamble that the intention of the bill is to enhance the facilitation of extensive new gas developments, and this intention is further signaled by the inclusion and definition of the South African Gas Master Plan. If we look at the discussion document of the Master Plan, it promotes and describes the so-called benefits of gas and details various mechanisms through which gas demand can be stimulated. This includes South African power generation sector, and this master plan discussion document openly advocates for more gas to power developments. We've also obviously seen repeated statements from the minister signaling ambitions to expand the gas sector and unlock investment. And then we look at the integrated resource plan itself, which caters for 3,000 megawatts of new gas, for which a determination has already been issued. But we also know that there are, at this point in time, 18,000 megawatts of gas-to-power projects in the pipeline, in some form of application process. And if we look at all of these things together, we can see that there's obviously a huge political and commercial ambition to expand gas. Unfortunately, this is happening at a time when investment in fossil fuel infrastructure, including gas, will introduce unprecedented levels of risk to society. The scientific community, including the IPCC, tells us that in order to avoid major climate change risks and impacts, all efforts should be made to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. And in order to do that, we need to see a 45% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2030, which is a really steep reduction trajectory. And we also need to see net zero by 2050. And just in terms of net zero, we share the views of our colleagues at the Climate Justice Charter Movement that net zero is potentially a dangerous target if it relies on future technologies to take carbon out of the atmosphere. And at this point in time, those don't exist. And we need to see net zero as absolute zero. And as a number of other submissions have highlighted, this 1.5 degree limit that we are trying to attain means 3 degrees for South Africa. Taken a look, Professor Nick King has recently released a report that takes a look at what different temperature increases mean for South Africa. And if we take a look at this summary of that report, we can see that as the temperatures increase, we're looking at issues like droughts, crop failures, health pandemics, migration as people move around to get away from climate impacts, and social disruption and violence. Chair, honourable members, there's sometimes a view that social and environmental concerns of this nature are anti-development. They are not, but they support development that protects human life and livelihoods. They do, however, challenge development that causes irreversible harm. This very real need to drastically decarbonize our economy has resulted in gas sometimes being presented as a cleaner or more climate-friendly form of energy production and use, and it has become widely known in some circles as a bridging fuel. This, however, uses incorrect and inadequate information to justify the claim that extensive gas infrastructure is needed for the transition to a decarbonized energy system. The claim that gas is cleaner and more climate friendly is based on a generally accepted findings that burning gas emits approximately 50% of the greenhouse gases as burning coal. And this is significant, but while that is a significant drop as compared to coal, it's still a significant amount of greenhouse gas. But most importantly, this does not account for the substantial and upstream greenhouse gas emissions of gas, which actually negate any benefits over coal in gas power generation. Methane contributes a significant portion of greenhouse gas emissions causing warming and make up to 25% of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. If we look at the full life cycle of greenhouse gas emissions of gas, we need to consider what we call fugitive emissions or leakage of the methane that occurs at various points in the supply chain. That's at extraction, transport, storage, liquefaction, and at point of use. Conventional gas has been found to result in 2.8 to 3.5% of leakage, and we can make all of these studies available to the committee. And this goes up to 3.6 up to 7.9% for shale gas production or fracking. And it is estimated that a 2.7% leakage rate will cancel out any climate benefits that gas has over coal. And this leakage is the norm. The industry has been trying to address this since inception, but this kind of escape of fugitive emissions is something that we just need to take as a given. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, and it has a global warming potential that is 84 times higher than carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. And for LNG, additional carbon emissions are produced during the energy-intensive liquefaction process. And liquefaction, tanker transport, and regasification add between 8 and 21% to the carbon footprint of this kind of gas. According to the United Nations Environment Program, in a May 2021 report, in the absence of additional policies and measures, methane emissions are projected to continue rising through to at least 2040. Current concentrations are well above levels in the 2-degree scenarios under the IPCC situation, and the Paris Agreement's 1.5-degree target cannot be achieved at a reasonable cost without reducing emissions by 40 to 45% by 2030. According to Richard Haworth, who was quoted by a previous speaker, to only reduce emissions of carbon dioxide without reducing methane emissions is far less effective, essentially contributing nothing over the short term. Global warming only starts to slow after 30 or more years of reduced carbon dioxide emissions. He goes on to state that over the next 20 years, methane emissions from all sources globally are contributing as much to global warming as are the total emissions of carbon dioxide. So these next 20 years are a critical time given the very high risk of global runaway warming and climatic disruption. Based on these considerations, the International Energy Agency, also quoted by a previous speaker, released its Net Zero by 2050 report in July of this year, and it states that in order to reach net zero by 2050, no new oil or gas fields can be developed as at the date of that report. According to the United Nations Environmental Program, reducing human-caused methane emissions is one of the most cost-effective strategies to rapidly reduce the rate of warming and contribute significantly to global efforts to keep us to 1.5 degrees. Honourable members, this is probably why 100 nations signed the Methane Pledge at COP26. South Africa was not one of them. And that pledge is to reduce methane by 30% by 2030 in order to keep us to the 1.5 degrees. It can therefore be seen that the position that gas-based energy production and use is climate-friendly and clean is misleading, and it's actually dangerous given what's at stake. In terms of gas to electricity in South Africa, last year Meridian Economics released a report, the focus of which was to look at how South Africa can meet its power demands in the coming decades while drastically reducing emissions from electricity generation. Some of the key findings of that report are that South Africa does not need to expand gas infrastructure to support the power sector for the foreseeable future, and that such a decision can be made in 10 to 15 years' time from now. Again, this report can be made available to the committee. Chair, I'm now going to hand over to my colleague, Gabrielle, who will take a look at the economic risks.
Thank you, Brandon, and thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to present these views. The production of gas reserves in South Africa, as this bill attempts to enable and promote, presents a range of economic risks for South Africa. And I'm going to speak to stranded assets first, reminding that stranded assets are those that, at some time prior to the end of their economic life, are no longer able to earn an economic return. So we're therefore considering the lifetime of gas production assets and the energy transition timeline, both of which appear to be competing and incongruent with one another. And we've seen this in 2021 more than ever before. There's this race to net zero by 2050, or the race to completely negate the greenhouse gas emissions caused by human activity, and the seemingly opposing race of the oil and gas industry to develop fossil fuel reserves. As Comrade Simane said earlier, the race to extract fossil fuels in our country really does undermine the South African government's own nationally determined contributions and its low emission development strategy. Now, the risk that is posed by the stranded assets argument is that gas projects are typically a 30-year plus project timeline. And as decarbonization laws in South Africa continue to get applied more vigorously, and as policies, targets, and financial pressures become more restrictive, we foresee that there's a very real risk that gas infrastructure and developments will no longer be viable and will indeed be illegal to operate long before the end of their economic timeline or lifespan. And if we take the one example of Total producing gas reserves or intending to produce gas reserves in Boipelo and Leeuwpan, potentially by 2028 reaching first gas, 2028 plus a conservative 30-year lifespan takes us to 2058. With the net zero intention of South Africa, that would mean the asset being stranded potentially 10 years prior to the end of its lifespan, which is an incredible risk for South Africa, the public, and those companies. Now, this conversation really around stranded assets and the prediction thereof needs to look to international experiences and international research around assets that are already being stranded. The Carbon Tracker platform, for one, notes that there's already examples of international coal mines, coal and gas power plants, and other hydrocarbon reserves that have become stranded by the low carbon transition, especially in the global north. And similarly, in May of this year, the International Energy Agency, which we must note is has previously been an oil and gas centric organization, but they themselves concluded that the exploitation and development of new oil and gas fuels must stop this year, and no coal-fired power stations must be built in order for the world to stay within safe limits of global heating and meet the goal of net zero emissions by 2050. And it's just so interesting to look at that being the position that the IEA is taking and position that an oil and gas-centric organization is taking. And this further motivates that this bill is not needed because new gas production is heavily opposed on the local, as we've seen more than ever in the previous month, and the national and the international stages. I'm now going to speak to carbon border taxes. So this really means that goods and services created using fossil fuel energy are going to have a higher carbon footprint due to the direct and indirect greenhouse gas emissions caused in their production. The European Union introduced the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism recently, which will levy a fee on all imports based on their carbon footprint. And an extensive gas-powered electricity system and a fossil fuel-powered industrial heating system will ensure that our exporters are heavily penalized and their competitiveness in the international industry is on the international industry is at risk. Now, touching on climate financing, we've seen this recently at COP26. There are a range of climate particularly is viewed as an attractive destination for this financing. But in order to remain attractive to the global north for these financing opportunities, we need to send the right signals by embracing strong emission reduction measures and avoiding expanding our carbon intensive fossil fuel use, such as gas. This energy transition and the climate financing is vital to funding our mitigation and adaptation measures and assist with implementing South Africa's just energy transition. Sort of linked to the availability of climate financing and how we're viewed by the international stage is our reputational risk. With an extensive rollout of gas infrastructure, energy generations and services brings with it a reputational risk, whereby South Africa is seen as a reckless and unnecessarily intensive carbon emitter, and this would compromise our investment opportunities and deprive the economy of growth opportunities. Finally, to touch on litigation risk, this again we've seen in 2021 more than ever before. As more stakeholders align with the imperatives of halting global warming, the risk of climate litigation increases. There have been more than 1,000 climate litigation cases launched around the world between 2015 and 2020. And climate activists everywhere are using courts to hold big emitters accountable. There have been landmark successes in recent months, and these suggest a trend being set to continue as the imperative to slash emissions and ditch fossil fuels grows even greater. So internationally, over the last 2 years, we've seen a trend in courts telling national governments specifically that they are not doing enough to reduce their country's greenhouse gas emissions. At home in South Africa, Our courts have already recognized that new coal-fired power stations and developments are contrary to climate change imperatives, and the ever-building climate science relating to gas will result in a similar movement against gas and legal challenges being brought to gas, big emitters, and the government to stop the developments from going ahead. Thank you, Brandon, and thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Gabrielle. In terms of physical risk, the IPCC report released in August indicates that the scientific community is more certain than ever about the impacts of global warming, the links between greenhouse gas emissions and warming, and the severity and the timescales of these impacts. The impacts are well described in our written submission, and we're just going to add here the key findings from this IPCC report as they relate to South Africa. Under all scenarios, South Africa is going to experience increasing heat waves and extreme hot weather events. South Africa is one of the relatively few regions globally that is going to experience a decrease in mean average rainfall and an increase in droughts as a result of global warming. Soil moisture levels are therefore going to decrease. And this is very alarming news given that we are a water scarce country. Rainfall events are going to increase. So while the overall rainfall goes down...
There'll be 2 minutes left now.
Thank you, Chair. While overall rainfall goes down, when it does rain, it rains more severely, leading to flooding risk. And there are also risks of tropical storm impacts for Northern KZN and Limpopo Valley. These in turn give rise to certain risks like food insecurity and the viability of the agricultural sector, shortages of clean water, a badly handled transition to low carbon energy, heat stress, and disrupted ecosystems and loss of biodiversity. South Africa is already falling behind in its global obligations to address climate change, and our NDCs are only just within the 2-degree range. And the upper range of our NDCs falls well short of the necessary 1.5 degrees. So the nature of climate change is such that the impacts are widespread and severe. And it is therefore essential that our comments that relate to public participation, adequate consultation, and administrative justice are taken into account. And all in all, we need to see this bill dramatically different in order to ensure the socioeconomic and environmentally sustainable development. We need to manage the economic risk that comes out of this activity. We need to elevate and center climate change considerations. Honorable members, I know there's a view that perhaps says that climate change concerns should sit with the DFFE and the Climate Change Act. But if we look at the climate change bill, it calls for unprecedented levels of collaboration across departments and ministries, and it calls for each sector to take its share of responsibility in dealing with climate change. And therefore, we believe that this bill also needs to center climate change and that the administrative justice considerations are strengthened given the severity of the impacts on all levels of our society. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You are exactly on point on time. Who's next is Miss Marlene Billy.
Thank you very much.
It's exactly 8 minutes past. It means by half past you must be done. 8 minutes past. Thank you.
Thank you to the chairman and members of the portfolio committee for the opportunity to expand on the issues and concerns that are raised in my written submissions on the gas amendment bill and for considering this input in your evaluation of the bill. I'm a member of the public and have followed the Karoo fracking issue since 2011 and continue to follow fracking and other gas-related projects, activities and impacts in South Africa and elsewhere. Fracking has been banned in many countries. California is to ban fracking in 2024 and is already cutting back on issuing new permits. Have the relevant committees, ministers and departments researched the reasons why these countries have banned fracking? The issues that I cover with the science, methane emissions, IPCC IPCC climate change report, human rights and health-related topics are easily accessible in the public domain. I include links and further reading for the committee for easy access to the information. Once one hears, one cannot unhear. Once one knows, one cannot unknow. This science and information may be useful also for the committee in its oversight and monitoring role over the Minister and Department of Mineral Resources and Energy. When we look at costs, we also need to look at the costs to the climate and to the impacted and affected people who live in mining affected areas, not only the monetary costs. With South Africa's dash for gas, an increasing number of permit applications for various onshore and offshore gas projects developments and the proposed importation of methane, such as a proposed coal power ships with a 20-year contract that would be supplied with imported natural gas. With imported natural gas, we need to be cognitive of the health, environment, and other impacts suffered by people and communities where this fracking is, where the fracking has taken place to provide us with imported gas. They are collateral damage and sacrifice zones, as people and communities would also be in South Africa if fracking is permitted. Are fracking permit exploration applications lining up in South Africa? The other one is the current seismic survey permits of the east coast of South Africa and wide country and countrywide public protests against offshore and oil and gas drilling, which is precursor to offshore oil and gas development, and the wide national and international media coverage. The mega methane 5,000 gas pipeline network around our country through farming areas and through 140 municipalities with multiple industrial sized compressor stations built along its length that vent gas. And this will tie South Africa into decades of fossil fuel production and greenhouse gas emissions. Next slide, please. If Mr. Kotzer could put that on. Thank you. Part of the preamble of the Gas Amendment Bill states that the purpose of the amendment is to provide for socioeconomic and environmentally sustainable development and to facilitate gas infrastructure development and investment. This statement does not acknowledge the fact that gas is a fossil fuel and that the extraction, distribution, processing, and consumption of this resource is a key and primary driver of greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. This further places the bill and South Africa directly at odds with the Paris Climate Agreement, to which South Africa is a signatory, which requires divestment from and a reduction in the extraction of all fossil fuels. And this bill seeks to facilitate further investments in the gas sector. Our challenge is, will awareness in South Africa of the code red level of our present climate crisis lead to action, to our reduction of gas-related operations and their global warming emissions, along with the reduction of other fossil fuels operation and our dependency? Or will South Africa continue to promote the development of the gas industry, as in the preamble of the bill, and with this knowingly increase our global warming greenhouse gas emissions? Will South Africa be on the right side of climate change and the right side of history? Or will South Africa be found to be on the wrong side of climate change and the wrong side of history? This committee, with its oversight role, has very important decisions to make. Next slide, please. This gas amendment bill is focused on infrastructure, transmission, storage, and related activities and processes. The health and pollution risks and impacts are also important during the fugitive emissions at each stage of the processing and transmission phase and operations. The many related industrial facilities, pipelines, compressor stations, waste disposal, transport, etc., and not only during the drilling and production phase. We cannot look at these two phases in isolation from each other. These risks and impacts cover the entire process from exploration to end usage, the entire lifetime of gas. Next, thank you. In the IPCC report on the 7th of August, 2021, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is the United Nations body for assessing the science related to climate change. Some key points in the report: South Africa is a climate change hotspot. Limiting other greenhouse gases and air pollutants, especially methane, could have benefits both for health and the climate. Cutting methane is the strongest lever we have to slow climate change over the next 25 years. We need international cooperation to urgently reduce methane emissions as much as possible this decade. The surge in methane is partly due to the increase of use of fossil fuels, especially gas produced by fracking. Next slide, please. Yes, thank you. Methane is a big new enemy in the battle over climate change. For the first time, the IPCC has focused on the need to drive down methane emissions. Countries need to figure out ways to make strong, rapid, and sustained reductions in methane emissions in addition to ramping down CO2. And then Professor Francois Engelbrecht, BITS Global Change Institute, South African climate scientist, was one of the lead authors of the IPCC report, and he gave a presentation, Implications for South Africa, for Africa and South Africa. The most recent science that has come out of the recently published IPCC report on climate change. It was hosted by the Climate Change Charter, EFS, BITS and COPAC. Next slide, please. The work undertaken by Sharon Wilson with Earthworks in detecting unseen emissions from gas infrastructures using a flow camera is internationally recognized. Sharon Wilson says, there would be no fracking boom if you could see through my lens. I want everyone to see oil and gas through my lens. Methane from oil and gas is accelerating climate change. There's a video of the emissions from a gas facility unseen to the naked eye, but are seen through a flow camera that is available for you to watch. There are more videos of emissions from gas facilities captured with a flow camera can be seen on Earthworks YouTube channel. The flow camera, you see what it is. It uses state-of-the-art, independently verified technology and is capable of detecting volatile organic compounds, VOCs, including known carcinogens and greenhouse gases. Next slide, please.
Sorry, ma'am. Let me correct my mistake again. You are supposed to be 28 minutes, not 28 minutes past, not 18 minutes past. Sorry. Apologies on that.
Thank you. The infrared flow camera detects greenhouse gas venting, fugitive emissions, and VOCs from gas facilities. Out of sight is not out of harm's way. Concerns over fracking spread far beyond well pad and gas or oil production. After gas or oil is brought to the surface, the industry needs a variety of equipment and facilities to process, transport, and deliver both oil and gas and their spin-off products from production to markets. And the cycle of pollution taken together, all this infrastructure can have wide-ranging impacts on communities and the environment. During the drilling, fracking, and extraction processes, significant amounts of fugitive gas emissions take place with serious implications for air pollution, climate change, and human health. Volatile organic compounds are emitted as gases from certain solids or liquids. Benzene, toluene, ethyl benzene, and xylenes are naturally present in many hydrocarbon deposits and may be present in drilling and fracking chemicals. These VOCs can cause symptoms such as headache, loss of coordination, and damage to the liver, kidneys. Benzene is a carcinogen as well. Next slide, please. Yes, thank you. Health and fracking, should the medical profession be concerned? In the South African Medical Journal in 2014, the authors wrote, health and fracking, should the medical professions be concerned? Rachel Mass, Jolyn Minar, and Bob Mash were the authors. These health concerns have not yet been fully addressed in policy making, and the authors recommend that the voice of health professions should be part of the public debate on fracking and that a full health impact assessment be required before companies are given the go-ahead to drill. In 2013, Professor Margaret Rafferty said that any initiation or further expansion of unconventional gas drilling must be preceded by a comprehensive health impact assessment. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thank you. Fracking is a public health issue, a human rights issue, an environmental justice issue, and a climate justice issue. The Constitution is the supreme law in South Africa. The environment and citizens need to be protected in all the many aspects and activities of fossil fuel operations. And environment, everyone has a right to an environment that's not harmful to their health and well-being and to have the environment protected for the benefit of present and future generations through reasonable legislative and other measures that prevent pollution and ecological degradation, promote conservation, and secure ecologically sustainable development and use of natural resources. Everyone has a right to an environment that is not harmful to their health or well-being. In the case of children, a child's best interest are of paramount importance in every matter concerning the child. Thank you. Next slide, please. The endocrine disruptor exchange. What is in the emissions from fracking oil and gas operations, and how do they affect us? TEDx, the endocrine disruption exchange, was pioneered by the late Dr. Theo Colburn. This research remains relevant to date. The oil and gas, TEDx oil and gas program pioneered the identification of health effects associated with unconventional oil and gas operations known as fracking. Many endocrine disruptors originate with fossil fuel extraction. Endocrine disrupting chemicals are chemicals that interfere with normal hormone action. The endocrine system is the body's exquisitely balanced system of glands, organs, and hormones that regulate such vital functions as body growth, response to stress, sexual development, production of insulin, and utilization of glucose metabolism and metabolism, neurodevelopment, intelligence, behavior, sleep patterns, blood pressure, and ability to reproduce. Chemicals that disrupt hormone function can have substantial and sometimes permanent impacts on health. Next slide, please. TEDx's oil and gas spreadsheets. You can find research related to the health impacts of chemicals used in unconventional oil and gas operations, including drilling, fracturing, and waste removal. TEDx's spreadsheets are tools for government and non-government organizations, the public, and scientists to have easy access to relevant research. In 2011, a report and list of 750 chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing was published by the United States House of Representatives Committee on Energy and Commerce. Chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing, this is easily available to be opened, and the public can have easy access to see that report. Next, please. I present to this committee today the compendium of scientific, medical, and media findings demonstrating risks and harms of fracking unconventional gas and oil extraction, the 7th edition, December 2020. The 8th edition is due to be published and launched shortly. The compendium is a fully referenced compilation of evidence outlining the risks and harms of fracking. It is a public open access document that is housed on the websites of concerned health professionals in New York and Physicians for Social Responsibility. The compendium is organized to be accessible to public officials, researchers, journalists, and the public at large. And there's more that can be looked at in there. It's a fully researchable and near-exhaustive citation database of peer-reviewed journal articles pertaining to shale gas and oil extraction, the repository for oil and gas energy research that was developed by PSC physicians, scientists, and engineers and is housed on their website. Next slide, please. New additions that will be included in the upcoming 8th edition of the compendium. I'm very grateful to Dr. Sandra Steingraber and Dr. Mikami Orenstein, two of the founders and lead authors of the compendium, who shared with me some of the titles, the new research that will be included in the new compendium still to be launched. Some of the titles are, in 2021, you can see these very latest research, fracking activities pose significant risks to the public health profile across the Oklahoma population, according to a unique study using a comprehensive health profile of the population across 76 counties over 20 years from 1998 to 2017. These are the titles of the research. Air pollution, methane super emitters, and oil and gas wells in Northern Carolina, the relationship with migraine headaches, prevalence, and exacerbation. Residential proximity to oil and gas drilling linked to lower birth weights in newborns. A Texas-based study on flaring found links between childhood asthma hospitalizations and both unconventional and conventional gas development. Next slide, please. A few of the topics, emerging trends in the compendium, a few of the topic headings, and if you go to the topic headings, clicking on any topic will take you straight to that section. Public health problems associated with drilling and fracking include poor birth outcomes, respiratory impacts, cancer, heart disease, and mental health impacts. Regulations are simply not capable of preventing harm. drilling and fracking activities bring naturally occurring radioactive material to the surface. Regulations cannot prevent air pollution. Regulations cannot stop wells from leaking. Fracking and natural gas are incompatible with climate solutions. So these are just some of the topic headings. Next slide, please. Health professionals are increasingly calling for bans or moratoria on fracking based on a range of health hazards and as reviews of the data confirm evidence for harm. Thank you. Next slide, number 15. The next one. Thank you. Drilling and fracking activities bring naturally occurring radioactive materials to the surface. Regulations cannot stop radioactive emissions. There's radiation at every stage of fracking and related facilities and operations, even in one's kitchen using gas to cook with. This is part of the reason, apart from geology, why radon test kits are featured in many United States homes. There's no known way to clean toxic radioactive frack blowback and waste to any safe levels for humans or environment. Various occupational health and safety acts in South Africa apply to workers dealing with hazardous chemicals and radioactive wastes. But importantly, what rights and health and safety legislation in South Africa applies to the public and communities similarly exposed to the known hazardous toxic chemicals and radioactivity from industrial oil and gas operations and infrastructures where communities live. We already know that there are many mining affected communities who are suffering health and other impacts. On the basis of the science and evidence, especially of natural gas and methane impacts, the recommendations that I propose are that the committees on mineral resources and energy, also health, environment, forest and fisheries, water and sanitation, Human Rights Commission, NERSA, the related ministers, departments, PASA, the energy regulator, and any other related body in gas and fossil fuel affairs, due to the many known impacts of gas activities and operations, note, record, and file the compendium for future reference, compendium of scientific, medical, and media findings demonstrating risks and harms of fracking and conventional gas and oil extraction. That the above committees, ministers, departments, and any other bodies involved in assessing or fossil fuel permit applications, and especially natural gas, take into account the contents of the compendium, adopt the precautionary principle until the known health issues and impacts are properly researched and proved safe for humans, the environment, and for the climate, instate a moratorium on fracking, on any fracking permits, including coal seam gas fracking, that a timeline of 6 months be given to address a policy on reducing gas development and dependency in South Africa and especially methane-related operations, that a timeline of 6 months be given to address the incorporation of a health impact assessment in assessing all fossil fuel permit applications and especially what gas fracking operations and all related infrastructures upstream and downstream. Due diligence requires that a health impact assessment be undertaken. Next slide, please. All wells eventually leak, casings and pipes rust, cement crumbles, and chemicals leach into groundwater. Thank you. From the current information and science that we have on climate change, methane's role, the IPCC report, I believe that South Africa cannot afford to embark on new gas infrastructure development, especially methane-related developments. I would also like to add, of concern from reports, apparently it may appear that some people allegedly may not have been able to enter some of the venues where these public hearings were recently held, or allegedly, apparently, maybe were prevented from entering some of the venues. If this may be so, will all such people be given the opportunity to make their oral input and to take part in the public participation process and have their say on this bill, their democratic right to be heard? I thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Exactly on time. We are, if I'm not mistaken, on Tetra 4. Yes, Tetra 4. You take us to 10 to 12.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and honourable members. My name is Wolf Fritz. I am the legal counsel representative for Tetra 4. Just a bit of an introduction. Tetra 4 is an emerging natural gas producer currently developing the Virginia Gas Project. It is the holder of the first and only onshore production right, as well as various exploration rights covering 187,000 hectares gas field across Balcom, Virginia, and Tennyson in the Free State. Currently produces compressed natural gas through its pilot plant and intends to produce liquid natural gas and liquid helium through its production right and development of the Virginia Gas Project. Tetra 4 extends is thanks to the Portfolio Committee on the Mineral Resources and Energy for giving Tetra 4 the opportunity to consult and comment on the gas amendment bill. And I'll hand you over to my learned colleague, Mr. Francois Hubert, to take you through the presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and the panel. Thank you for hosting us this morning. We will try and focus on the regulatory and the specific provisions within the proposed amendment bill, and specifically how this submission that we've written submission can be supported by just taking you through our main comments on the proposed wording of the bill. So what we're going to do is we're going to speak about mostly about the types of increases in the gas that are to be regulated under the amendment bill, some issues with definitions, the provision relating to registration requirements, clarity regarding the regulation of production activities, as well as the exclusivity provisions, and then we will end with some comments on the tariffs, the proposed tariff amendments. So in terms of the increase in the types of gases that are regulated, currently the Gas Act focuses on the regulation of piped hydrocarbon gases, as the current definition of gas under the Gas Act is defined as all hydrocarbon gases transported by pipeline. Similarly, the preamble of the Gas Act refers to the promotion of the orderly development of the pipe gas industry. It's our emphasis. But in accordance with the amendment bill, on the other hand, the amendment seeks to regulate all hydrocarbon gases, whether they are transported by pipeline or not, as the proposed definition of gas under the amendment bill no longer refers to gases transported by pipeline. There's also no reference to pipe gas in the proposed definition of distribution and the preamble of the amendment bill, which simply refers to the orderly development of the gas industry. And the proposed definition of gas in the amendment bill also expressly refers to regasified liquid petroleum gas, whereas the current definition in the Gas Act only refers to regasified liquid natural gas, with a little bit of our emphasis. The proposed definition would, in our view, create an ambiguous licensing and regulatory regime for domestic gas produced and regulated under the MPRDA. The MPRDA provisions that holders of a valid production right might explore, beneficiate, and sell their products is specifically relevant to these proposed changes. One must remember that in the amendment gas bill, reference is made to certain definitions which are already captured under the MPRDA. One must further be cognizant that the MPRDA is the instrument that has been mandated to regulate upstream activities, where an intended applicant for a production or exploration right follows the MPRDA provisions, together, of course, with the NEMA regulatory requirements in order to obtain such a right. The problem is that the amendment bill seems to create a a double regulatory dispensation, which is almost intended to regulate upstream activities under NERSA as regulator as opposed to the DMRE as regulator. So, our problem or our proposal is that these definitions should be amended to explicitly exclude domestic gas across the value chain, provided the entity operating in the value chain is regulated under the MPRDA. And that is in far as it relates to upstream activities. If we then look at the definitions, other definitions, definitions of storage, trading, just look here, distribution, and transmission, to mention a few, we see that there's a reoccurring ambiguity. If you look, for instance, at where the definition of storage and transmission refers to upstream processes, including the pipelines, including the drilling, including the pipelines to the liquefaction plant, all of those. Those definitions are already captured under production right areas and related definitions in the MPRDA. So you have an existing regulatory framework that governs upstream activities. You, in addition, you have a proposed bill in place, the Upstream Resources Development Bill, that is to regulate upstream activities. So there's a clear potential of ambiguity and double regulation under the NERSA regime as well. And that must be looked at very, very carefully. If you look at specifics, I'll take you through example, the definition of storage. The amendment bill proposes changing the definition of storage from holding of gas in as a service in the Gas Act to holding of gas in fixed infrastructure. Under the Gas Act, that is stored in pipelines which are used primarily for the transmission and distribution of gas, is excluded from the definition of storage. The amendment bill proposes increasing the number of excluded activities such that gas stored for own use at the transmission, distribution, liquefaction, or upstream pipeline, or where the primary purpose of such storage is for gas to be used in a production operation or in the manufacture of synthetic or artificial gas, is excluded from the definition of storage and accordingly would not require a storage license. So again, it is clear that the proposed definition might create an ambiguous licensing and regulatory regime for domestic gas produced and regulated, already regulated under the MPRDA. The MPRDA provisions that holders of a valid production right may explore, beneficiate, and sell their products is what needs to be the driver and the governance driver. The proposed definition should be amended to explicitly exclude domestic gas across the value chain. The same with, I'm not going to go through all the definitions in detail, but let's just take a few of them. The current definition of trading under the Gas Act is the purchase and sale of gas as a commodity by any person and any services associated therewith, excluding the construction and operation of transmission, storage, and distribution systems. The proposed definition of trading under the amendment book, however, is the sale of gas to a reticulator, to an end consumer, and by a transmission company or a distribution company, and any activity incidental thereto, including the construction operation of trading infrastructure, and specifically states that the construction and operation of liquefaction or regasification transmission, storage, and distribution facilities is excluded. So we again need to look at ways to redefine the definitions so that it clearly resorts either under the MPRDA as the overarching definition pool, then specifically linked upstream activities and their definitions to upstream legislation or legislation governing upstream, or it is in the process to be accepted as governing upstream activities. You cannot have a dual system where you already have an existing license to do all these things. Now you have to apply to the to NERSA, and who will govern the very same activities. And that is our biggest fear. The same applies to distribution. The same also applies to transmission. So to summarize on the definition side, there needs to be a relook, a reevaluation and review of the definitions. Currently, it creates an ambiguous dispensation where the same activities are covered under a multitude of statutory instruments. It needs to be horses for courses. And it is clear that the government's intention from a DMRE perspective is to amend the MPRDA to specifically cater that upstream activities are no longer covered under the minerals part of the MPRDA, but rather as a standalone under the proposed upstream petroleum development bill. And our submission is that once that upstream development bill is created and the Gas Act in its current proposed format comes into effect, there's going to be a massive regulatory conflict between which act actually or which regulator trumps each other. And there needs to be a very careful look at that. Then, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen of the Portfolio Committee, in terms of Section 8, in terms of Section 15.1, the Gas Act also defines, if I just go back to the definitions of the in the Gas Act, it defines production as the recovery, processing, treating, and gathering of gas from wells in the earth up to the boundary of the mine, or the manufacture of synthetic or artificial gas, or the manufacturing of any gases in the refining process up to the boundary of the factory, and any other activity incidental thereto. The definition is therefore wide enough to include any process of recovery, our emphasis, our submission, to include any process of recovery, processing, treatment, and gathering of gas within the boundary of a mine, including the physical process of liquefaction or regasification, which now, which requires a license in terms of Section 15.1 of the Gas Act. The current definition of production is accordingly problematic, as it is unclear whether a production plant should be licensed in terms of the Gas Act simply because it relies on the process of liquefaction or regasification to process or gather gas from the earth, and which are activities that are, in any case, currently regulated by the MPRDA. So given that the Gas Act regulates the secondary process of the transmission, storage, distribution, liquefaction, and regasification of gas, in our mind, the downstream activities, and not the primary process of exploration for or production of gas, which are all upstream activities, it is unlikely that the legislator's intention was that any person involved in liquefaction or regasification activities that are used in the course of the primary process of the production of gas would require additional licensing requirements for the same activity under the Gas Act, especially since upstream activities are already regulated in terms of the MPRDA. The amendment bill further seeks to address any potential confusion by removing the definition of production and replacing it with the definition of production areas, production operation and production right as defined in the NPRDA. The amendment bill also proposes including a definition for upstream pipeline, which is defined as a pipeline or one of a network of pipelines, which is operated or constructed as part of operations carried out under the production right. Or two, which is used to convey gas from a production area directly or indirectly to an upstream gas processing facility. The proposed definition of storage and transmissions in the amendment bill accordingly expressly exclude the storage and transport of gas by upstream pipeline. Therefore, under the amendment bill, it is clear that only the construction, conversion, or operation of liquefaction or regasification facilities involved in the downstream activities of the secondary process of the transmission, storage, distribution, liquefaction, and regasification of gas requires a license in terms of the amendment bill. And that's where we again reiterate that this will cause not only from a regulatory, but also from implementation and even pre-application, a planning process, it will create ambiguity. Remember, the drive is to work towards single regulatory systems, the one environmental system. But we cannot have three different legislative instruments regulating the same activity. Then I want to take you to section 15B1 of the amendment bill that talks around registration. And the amendment bill as such proposes an increase in the number of people obliged to register with NERSA and therefore be exempted from applying for and holding a license as the Schedule 1 for the performance of certain activities such as people involved in the exportation or importation of gas, not to be confused with production or importation of gas, purchasing gas and as an eligible customer, engaged in the transmission or distribution of gas. I'm going to jump ahead to the problem here. The Gas Act does not prescribe a time period for registration, so it was hoped that the amendment bill would provide more clarity as to how long an application for registration would take. Unfortunately, the amendment bill has not provided any time periods. Neither the pipe gas regulations nor the rules published in terms of the Gas Act prescribe a time period. So we are hoping that that could be amended. Then in terms of a very important aspect, we jump to tariffs. I will come back if I've got more time for exclusivity. But currently, the position under Section 4H of the Gas Act is that NERSA must monitor and approve and, if necessary, regulate the transmission and storage tariffs. Section 41M, read with Section 22B of the Amendment Bill, however, proposes that NERSA must regulate all tariffs and maximum prices that may be charged by a license.
Just a reminder, 2 minutes left.
Yeah, in order to recover its investment so that the licensee would recover its investment, recover its prudently and efficiently incurred costs, and make a profit. Our problem, Mr. Chairman, is that it cannot be a discretionary, mandatory requirement only from nurse's perspective. You cannot create a mandatory single maximum tariff approach applicable to all holders and tell them how to recover their investments or how to make profit. That is their prerogative. So what we are hoping is that there will be amendment that reflects that the maximum tariff structure and or any other tariff structure must be agreed in concurrence with the holders and licensees. So to summarize, Mr. Chairman, the most important part is in order to develop this market effectively, a free trade concept should be allowed to flourish. The investor will need to make sure that their product is competitively priced against other sources of product or alternatives of their product. If not, their target customers will simply not procure their tariff. So a lot of more work needs to go in there. In conclusion, we need to look at the definitions again to align it with other legislative, existing legislative requirements. Two, we need to make sure that certain aspects like tariff determination is done in concurrence with the licensee. And that thirdly, there is not a system of dual licensing or a replica of license application. It must be one system that is driven for upstream activities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Pa Tangi. Chalebucha. Honorable members, in the same vein, we have that four presentation from what is it? Don't want to call names that are not and I from South Durban. I nearly said South Basin. You said that's why South Durban. There was a Center for Environmental Rights. There was Miss Marlene Lilly, and then there was Tetra 4. Any in the same way, which clarities would want? Any clarities that would need that might help yourselves as committee members when you deliberate? Going one. Yes, Mr. Masauli.
Thank you very much, Chair. Greetings to you, greetings to my colleagues, and greetings to the department. And I greet all those who made presentations as well as the observers. Chair, just one to South Durban. Towards the conclusion of the presentation, she mentioned that she doesn't believe that we have been, or there has been a conduct of proper, she termed proper and effective public participation. Now, the question would be, which I think will help the committee, what in her view constitute proper and effective public hearing, different what we have been doing, different to what we are doing, and different to what we will be doing next year. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other one? Okay. In the absence, can I give South Durban? But I thought what they were saying was that first they mentioned the number of areas, for an example, in KZN that they should have been touched. We should have touched based with one, two, the choice of the venue, three, which I think that's what they were saying critically, was that the department, as far as they know, has not done any interaction with the public, and they believe that it should have been the department on its own should have conducted public hearings on the proposed amendment bill. But I don't want to get employment through the back door. South Durban.
Thanks, Chair. I think yes. Just to respond to those public participation questions. Exactly what you said. We were concerned with the venue choice. KZN being such a large province, there were only two venues chosen. And the location of the venue in Durban wasn't easily accessible to the masses. And specifically in our case, we were approached literally the week before the public hearing by the office, I think it was an officer, an education officer. And I did send a letter in beforehand last week to the office to say that we were very upset by this approach because we were requested a week before that we were going to get education materials, which we needed to hand out to the community or give contacts for them to hand out. And we found a week was not sufficient for communities to engage with material that's contained within a bill. And these are ordinary people. They need to have one-on-one discussions or public forum that can actually explain it. So in terms of maybe road shows, a knock-and-drop approach, we didn't see any advertising in the local papers. And when I did go to the Durban hearing, which wasn't, there were people attending, but there was no diversity in the attendance. So I wanted to also find out how did these people even hear about it. And the documentation there that was available, we only had English, when we know the majority of our speakers in KZN speak isiZulu. So it's things like that that we felt should have been better planned. We need that time frame for communities to engage with the material because they need to understand the detail as well, because this is a piece of legislation that affects the masses and the environment, and it can't just be pushed through. It has to be effective, inclusive, and quite thorough at this level. And so that was what we meant by effective public participation. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, ma'am. Look, I see there's Gabriela. Is it you, ma'am?
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to add and echo to what Cassandra's just mentioned. Right before the first set of public hearings, the Center for Environmental Rights, on behalf of Groundwork, wrote a letter to yourself, Chair, and the PCC regarding the public participation processes and the view that Groundwork and CER took that it was inadequate time for preparation for presentations at that first set of public hearing. It was a week notice. So I think Cassandra has very adequately expressed the views of CBOs, and I just want to say thank you and to echo that. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Look, I wanted us to deal so that we are not accused tomorrow to deal with those that the questions were directed to that would have made a presentation, but that's okay. Safe to say, I think from a point of view from where we sit, we have responded both at the venue when we were there Saturday. We did explain the question of securing the venue, and unfortunately, it is beyond a committee of parliament to secure the venue. You get the venue that is being made available by the municipality. I even made an example. I said would have preferred to go to one of the second biggest townships in South Africa, which is Umlazi. But when people in Umlazi are not giving us a venue, we can't go to Umlazi. If we can't get the city hall in Durban, we're told it's full, there's nothing we can do. We get the venue that is supplied to us. But let's leave those issues. I'm definitely sure we all know that we've got a recourse when we are dissatisfied, including with the answer that is provided by the committee on behalf of the committee. If members don't have any questions, can I then say that we'll still continue with this oral submission based on written submissions with other stakeholders that have written to us? Secondly, we have not finished the lag of public consultation. We're still gonna go to other four provinces. I must repeat again to everyone. Unfortunately, we go according to the guidance of Parliament. The time allocated, the areas where the period that we could spend, which is the same way committees of Parliament have got an allocated time, an allocated day. We are one of the few, if I were to say, lucky committees, that this committee meets almost every Tuesday, depending whether Parliament is not in recess. If Parliament in recess, no committee can convene. That's an, in essence, this committee meets or is supposed to meet twice a week, which is on a Thursday from 9 to 12 and on a Friday from 9 to 12, depending again whether there is no house sitting on a Friday. If there's house sitting on a Friday, we'll have to make alternative. Equally, even on a Tuesday, if the house sitting is starting early at 10, it means the committee may not sit or it will have to sit between 9 and quarter to 10. Unfortunately, those are technical things that I explained in many of these areas. We can't bore people about them. As a committee, we don't meet as and when we wish. We meet as and when we are granted permission to meet. So you make an application for every meeting that you are going to have. It must get an approval. It must be included on the set list so that it can be known that in the public that the committee will be meeting. So we would love to do some of the things. Unfortunately, as I'm saying, we have to follow what the rules on committees of Parliament says. On that note, we don't want us to, I don't think it will be fair to sit and make a judgment on your presentation. You are doing this in order to influence the thinking of members of the committee, but also at the same time is that when the committee would have finalized its work, you also seek to influence some of the members of Parliament or members of the National Assembly in this case, who might be watching and listening so that in the event the committee finalizes this report, it takes it to the, as I outlined, we have to take it now to Parliament, to the National Assembly with the recommendations of what the committee is saying. If it gets adopted by the National Assembly, then it will have to go to the National Council of Provinces. If it is not, then it means it will have to find another way, either it gets referred back to the department. I'm not sure whether that is possible, but the point is, you are shaping us to say, as you go and look at these things. That is why I said in some of these visits we had, I don't believe in the principle of public hearings. I believe in the principle of public consultation. Public hearings could mean we go, we listen, or we hear you, and that's it. But consultation, it means we hear you and we seek to act on some of the things that you are making us aware. And unfortunately, as I say that, it does not necessarily mean we have. We must listen to even what we may not necessarily be in agreement. On that note, can I then say we will be meeting, excuse my fact that I'm in a very bad space as far as network is concerned, so I had to reinforce network by not showing the view to other. Normal circumstances, you should know and see the person who's presiding over your meeting. It might happen that you are sitting with Mini Vanelli. You hear the voices, but the actual person is mimicking. So please bear with me. That one, I must extend my apologies. We will then, with the others, meet on Friday. What time are you and Ayanda?
At 9 o'clock again, Chair.
Yeah, Friday 9 o'clock. We are continuing with the other team. Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned.
Recording stopped.
Gotcha.